Okay, so you might hear a little bit of drilling in this next segment. It's not drilling for oil in Alaska, although we are talking about the environment. There's a little construction going on here in the building where the BPP World Headquarters
There
resides.
are those who say we should not have erected the studio atop the DeWalt power drill testing facility. To that, we said, "You are fools. This will not be a problem." Well, the chickens have come home to roost.
In that spirit, we shall persevere, we shall move forward, and we're going to talk about what else? Saving the planet. You might think, hey, I'm not supposed to, buy an SUV. I'm supposed to hate nuclear power. I'm supposed to love organic milk. Not necessarily. The good folks at Wired Magazine say there are many old ways that people have thought that we should save the environment. Not so true. The biggest threat to Mother Earth is global warming. Wired dedicates its 15th anniversary issue to the so-called new environmentalism. The article says combating climate change by reducing carbon emissions should be our top green agenda, and focusing on other related causes like saving the polar bear or cleaning up the oceans, this can actually dilute that bigger effort. And that makes sense when you consider a study that was out this month from the University of Bern reporting that greenhouse gases are the highest they've been in 800,000 years. Really? We were measuring this 800,000
I
years
just kind
ago?
of assume with the first 790,000 that that would be the case, but.
So, as Wired says, forget the spotted owl, go buy a windmill instead. Joining us now to explain why winning the war on global warming means maybe slaughtering some of environmentalism's sacred cows is Spencer Reese. He's a contributing editor for Wired who worked on June's cover story titled Inconvenient Truths: Get Ready to Rethink What It Means to Be Green. Hey, Spencer.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, lots of interesting stuff here. So the overall point of the cover story is that, yes, there are a lot of threats to the environment, but global warming is the biggest. But why does it have to be zero sum, which it seems like you're arguing? Why does focusing on climate change mean you can't support spotted owls?
Well, because in this world, you can't have everything. I mean,
come on, we're American. We can have everything.
Yeah, well, I know we want. Actually, you can. I mean, I think we can. But let me first just run down a couple. I mean, they're really obvious things. You know, for years and years, people have opposed, say, nuclear power plants. Well, we need electricity. So what did the power plant companies do? They went out and built coal plants instead, which were seemingly okay to people. And now, as a result, we've got massively more greenhouse gases than we would have had if we built nukes. So now everyone's saying, oh, my God, we've got to build nukes. That's a kind of classic example. You know, windmills for a long time faced opposition because, oops, they chop up birds that fly through them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, actually, you know, the most recent generation ones don't do that as badly as they used to, but that resulted in a lot of projects got stopped. Those are the kind of things that, you know, it is sort of zero sum at that level.
So let's go through a few more of these. The 10 tenets that you call the new environmental apostasy,
right,
kind of break down into things that sound like they're the best thing for the planet, but really not so much, and things that seem like the worst for the planet, but really aren't. So let's start with cars, because
right,
a lot of people get latched onto this idea of SUVs being evil, 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 and, you know, what would Jesus drive? Not that, apparently. Maybe he would drive
well,
a hybrid, like a Prius or something.
Yeah. See, again, I mean, everybody, you know, like lots of people like to drive around in a little Prius. You know, a yuppie in his Prius is getting 42 miles a gallon. A mom in a Hummer with six kids in the back on a per-person basis, which is really the way you got to look, is actually doing much better. So a lot depends on what you do with the car. Okay, how many people are in it, where you're going, whether it's important. All those kind of things can vastly outweigh, you know, the 10 miles per hour per gallon better that a Prius might get. But the problem with the Prius is everybody, you know, the nickname is the Pius, because everyone thinks, oh, I bought the Prius, end of problem. Well, not exactly.
So what about used cars?
Used cars are great, actually. You want to, you know, 52 mile a gallon. The world champ is still about an 84 Honda Civic. You know, gets way better mileage than a Prius does. It doesn't have an air conditioner. It doesn't have airbags. It doesn't have a lot of things that people have now come to expect in cars. But, you know.
So if I can get my hands on a used Hummer, then that's a better idea.
Yeah, another big factor is, you know, how much carbon goes into building a car. It's a huge amount. And, I mean, a lot of this stuff, I mean, one of the tenets I wanted to put in this thing, which we didn't include, was if you start looking at this stuff seriously, you get either a big headache or go crazy. Because, you know, just trying to figure out, wow, well, maybe we should just not build any more new cars and just run around with the old ones. But actually, no, that really isn't a very good idea either, because in the long run, you do want to move to more efficient cars. But just, you know, going out and splashing $40,000 on a brand new car is not, again, going to by itself really change anything.
It's about behaviors, changing behaviors as well. You can't just buy your way into a better planet.
Really important and very long-term, big systemic stuff, you know, moving, say, to electric cars, you know, is really a much better solution, because then, you know, you have all kinds of ways you can make them go. You can make them go with solar power. You can make them go with wind power. You can make them go with nuclear power. You're not wed to this one fuel, whether it's ethanol or gasoline or whatever it happens to be.
What about organics?
Organics, again, same kind of thing. You know, people, you know, think, oh, wow, I'm going to eat organic lettuce. But then it turns out it was grown in a greenhouse that had to be kept warm through the winter, because you, of course, want to have your lettuce in the middle of January in New York. Well, lettuce doesn't grow in New York in January. So if you want to have organic lettuce, it either has to be shipped in, you know, a very long distance, or it has to be grown in a greenhouse that's kept warm by probably natural gas. So there you go. It from a carbon point of view, you know, you really want to eat what grows locally, which unfortunately in much of the United States and much of the world, much of the year, the answer is not much. You know, get used to potatoes and turnips.
Spencer, I read this story in the New York Times yesterday about kids in a college who test each other on taking shorter showers than the one before them. And I said, well, that's great for them. And by great for them, actually, I kind of was saying to myself, it's essentially meaningless in the overall picture about fighting.
I mean, there was a great line that I think David Pogue in the New York Times had a couple weeks ago. He said, you know, don't think that, you know, that the glaciers on Mount Kilimanjaro are melting because you listen to too much heavy metal music on your iPod. It's, you know, there's limits to that behavior change that we talked about. And, you know, it depends. You know, everybody says you got to do something. It's more important to do something than to do nothing.
Yeah.
I think the answer is, to back to your original point about zero sum, you got to do both. You know, you got to both be smart about your own life and what you do, and also smart about the policies that you know, either with your vote or your money or whatever, encourage.
I have always said to friends of mine, all that is fine, but the most important thing you could do is get the government to change big policies. If you have 2 hours a week to work on environmentalism, if you could somehow channel it to that, that's the best thing to do in terms of saving the planet.
Yeah, but even there, you got to make smart choices. You know, yeah. I mean, one of the odd things about this whole exercise, Wired Magazine is a technology magazine. We're not really an environmental magazine. And we're basically pretty optimistic about the world. And, you know, one of the reasons we're optimistic is that we really believe that there are technological ways to, in effect, have your cake and eat it too. Okay, you don't have to, you know, I mean, that's what I was hitting at with electric cars. You know, there are ways that, you know, plenty of people sit around and, you know, there are ways to devise a world which is both fun and where you can take half-hour showers if you feel like it and not ruin the planet. But it's just going to require a pretty serious rethink, because again, as we started this project, you know, the world isn't engineered right now with carbon reduction in mind. It's engineered with efficiency in mind. It's measured with cost, affordability, all those things. In order to have your cake and eat it too, it's really hard. Engineers have to do a lot of work, but I think we can do it. And I mean, one of our great advantages right now are things like computers. You know, for instance, internet, you know, just an obvious thing, can help people not commute as much, not take as many business trips. Those kind of things really do have effects. It's just going to take a while for them to work through the system.
Spencer, what do you think the effect of peer pressure has? I mean, I take Mike's point that if you have 2 hours a week, it's good to lobby at a federal level. But also, I think setting an example, or what's the value in maybe that an element of shame, you know, when the whole plastic bags thing, if you walk out of a grocery store.
You got to be smart about it. So, friends, I mean, you guys, you're in New York, you're actually in a really green place. I mean, it doesn't look, when you look out the window of New York City, you don't think green. But actually, on a per-person basis, New York's one of the greenest because it's a very highly concentrated city. People take public transportation. It's easy to heat and cool an apartment house as opposed to a little, you know, the cute little cabin in the woods that most people would think of as a green ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you gotta first start by having your head screwed on right and understanding, working through in your head, you know, the whole. Everything is about systems in this. You know, energy is the classic networked product, and so its effects extend, ripple out backwards and forwards, up and down a kind of a food chain, and every single thing you do has impact on everything else, and you really have to think about it.
Spencer Reese is a contributing editor for Wired magazine and an editor of June's cover story, Inconvenient Truths, Get Ready to Rethink What It Means to Be Green. It's an interesting article. Some things you kind of, they'll surprise you. I encourage everyone to check it out. Spencer, thanks very much.
We hope so. Thank you very much.
Thanks for sharing your reporting. We appreciate it.
Bye.
Rachel, you ever go to online and enter one of those personal carbon footprint calculators?
No. Have you done that?
Yeah. And I find that the number one thing that lowers your personal carbon footprint is not having a car. So that's why living in a city,
is
pretty much the greenest thing you can do. And once you start adding even a small amount of miles, you really see that your personal carbon footprint has gone out of control.
It's true.
Yes.
It's
and true. And then, although I feel a little bad about owning a pet because his carbon paw print is a little larger than you'd think it would.
But, you know, shame really worked with the plastic bag thing. As soon as I saw all my neighbors carrying those recycling bags, I was like, well, I feel embarrassed to carry this plastic bag. So.
Yeah, they whisper about you. Plastic bag and
B4.
Coming up on The Big Show, we strive towards broadcast sustainability, and we talk about the rationale behind human irrationality. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
We're so deep.
The online movie rental company Netflix may not know when you're sleeping or know when you're awake, but they sure do track and sort the rental preferences of their subscribers. And now their website can show you what members are renting by city or zip code. So, are video tastes on the Upper West Side of Manhattan notably different from those in Manhattan, Kansas? We asked Mary Horowitz, the director and chief operating officer of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center, and both an opera librettist and a former NPR executive before he went off to the Cayman Islands with our travel budget to scroll through some of those Netflix selections. He joins us in our studio.
Promise not to tell. He's like,
Murray, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here, Scott, as always. Thanks so much for having me.
What do you notice?
First of all, we have to get the ground rules straight. It says at the top, members in and around your town here are currently renting these titles much more than other Netflix members. It's not the most rented. I'm sure everybody's renting, you know, Spider-Man 3 and The Bourne Ultimatum and No Country for Old Men. It's just that these films are more rented in this town than they are in other towns.
Yeah.
And the pattern that emerged is people are really parochial. It started out in Washington, right?
Yeah.
Among the first five films in Washington are K Street, the complete series.
Gosh, of course, yeah.
And Goodbye, Lenin. And then Our Brand is Crisis, which is about, you know, political imaging. And even on the
this
list,
is real imaginative.
You know what I'm
Washington
saying?
Filmgoers, yeah.
Number 11,
yeah.
Mr. Smith Goes
oh,
to Washington.
Oh, my gosh. It's like, a tribute, though, to a great film. By
so friend. I figured, okay, look, what's the city with the reputation, at least, for being the most sophisticated? So I go up I-95 or up the Amtrak railway to New York, New York.
Okay.
Number one, next stop, Greenwich Village. Number two, Barefoot in the Park. So then I figure, okay, I'm looking in the wrong places. You know, Billings, Montana, Casper, Wyoming. Comanche Moon, The Road to Lonesome Dove. It's like Broken Trail, the TV's also with Robert Duvall. And so I decided you and I have hometowns. I decided we'd put our hometowns
both in the Midwest.
In the Midwest,
yeah.
Dayton, Ohio, and Chicago, Illinois. So I decided to go head-to-head with you. Yeah. I'm going to read to you now the first five films that members in and around Chicago, Illinois are currently renting more than other Netflix members.
Yeah.
H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer, which
yes,
is about
Chicago.
Right,
yes.
Chicago. Expo, Magic of the White City, about
Chicago.
Wicker Park.
Chicago.
Call North Side 777.
Jimmy Stewart Chicago movie, yes.
The Blues Brothers.
All right.
So then I go to Dayton,
yes,
right?
Finally.
Multiplicity, Holes, Wedding Days, Robots, and Ladder 49. And I was completely befuddled. Either Dayton is as eclectic and inclusive and democratic as I want to believe it always has been, or this is all completely meaningless.
Murray Horowitz, Director and Chief Operating Officer at the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center. This is NPR News.
The economy is struggling, and everyone, it seems, is looking for ways to cut costs. In some cases, saving money can also lead to saving the planet. We're going to look at two sustainable practices that help buffer the economic downturn. We'll hear how planting vegetable seeds can lower your grocery bill. First, we look at the manufacturing industry. Oil, natural gas, and coal used to make products is one of the biggest expenses. A Chicago entrepreneur thinks he has a way for factories and refineries to reduce those costs and pollution by recycling the energy they already burn. NPR's David Shaper reports.
Ever notice the nuclear power plant in The Simpsons? You know, the one Homer Simpson works at? Tom Kasten does. He's chairman of suburban Chicago-based Recycled Energy Development. And when looking at a picture of the cartoon power plant on his desk, he zeroes in on something.
Giant amounts of steam coming out of the cooling towers, basically reflecting that 2 out of every 3 units of energy are being thrown into the air as waste heat.
That's right. Kasten says for every 3 units of fuel, like oil, gas, or coal that's burned to make electricity, 2 are wasted. The heat just escapes into the air. As Homer Simpson would say,
don't!
Kasten sees heat being wasted everywhere, not just in cartoon power plants, but at real ones, as well as at steel mills, factories, and refineries.
When you've learned what I've learned and you carry my concern for global warming, you see those stacks of steam as immoral and very dangerous.
For the last 30 years, Tom Kasten has been working to develop profitable ways to capture waste heat and turn it into power.
There are many industrial processes that emit high-temperature exhaust. The energy coming out is a very high temperature. You can use that high temperature energy to boil water, make steam, and drive an electric generator.
And that's what's happening here at the giant ArcelorMittal steel mill in East Chicago, Indiana.
This is a platform that's about 200 feet in the air.
Standing high above the sprawling steel mill on an open graded platform, John Prunkle, president of Primary Energy Recycling Corporation, points to a battery of coke ovens below, at least a quarter of a mile long.
There's a lot of heat down there. Coke is coal that's burned in an oxygen-deprived environment. And when you do that, you create and release a tremendous amount of heat, very hot, probably 2,500 degrees.
And this excess heat used to just drift away. But 10 years ago, Primary Energy contracted with the mill's owners to install boilers above the coke ovens to use the wasted heat to generate steam and electricity.
We could produce almost 100 megawatts of electrical generation out of the steam that's produced off of the waste heat that we're capturing here today.
That's enough electricity to power more than 60,000 homes. Recent EPA and Department of Energy studies suggest U.S. industries waste enough heat to generate an estimated 200,000 megawatts of power. That's nearly 20% of what this nation uses, enough electricity to replace up to 400 coal-fired power plants. And it's not just excess heat that can be recycled. In another part of the steel mill, waste gas from the blast furnace is captured and reused. It's a gas that is usually just burned off by a flare at the top of a stack. But when mixed with oxygen, it can be used just like natural gas. All totaled, energy recycling creates close to 250 megawatts of power at the steel mill. That's about half of the electricity it uses each day, saving tens of millions of dollars a year in energy costs and greatly reducing CO2 emissions. This type of energy recycling is commonplace in Northern Europe and Japan. Denmark generates more than half of its electricity this way. So why isn't it done more often here?
The real challenge is that it's typically illegal, and they've got to find a way to get around the laws.
Tom Kasten says state and federal laws protect monopoly utilities, often preventing energy recyclers from selling excess power back to the grid or running power lines across a street. Even the Clean Air Act prevents utilities themselves from recycling waste heat at older coal-fired power plants because any modification subjects them to newer regulations. But with soaring energy costs and an increasing push for green power, Kasten and others hope recycling energy can start to get as much attention as solar panels and wind power. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.